America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth when 43 remaining, exhausted, weary but relieved delegates were looking forward to a great day all of their own in September of 1787 in Philadelphia. After 4 long months of brilliance and bickering, of confrontation and compromise, they finally were getting done with a new constitution for a new nation, a new start for a government that had been floundering. Yeah, they had reached agreement on a constitution, but they weren't at all sure that it would be accepted. It was very, very firmly opposed, by some of the people who had been there the whole time and didn't like the result. The fight to draft the Constitution was Act One, but Act Two, and one of the most dramatic threats to the survival of the new Union, was the fight to ratify the Constitution. They needed to get 9 states out of the 13, at least, to approve this document. Otherwise, the entire thing was a waste. And part of the way they did it, part of the way they accomplished ratification, is part of the miracle of the Constitution, the subject of this very special broadcast. Part of what troubles me about the way people think about and often talk about the Constitution of the United States is they think that people came together, they argued, they agreed, they got a new document together that laid out a charter of liberty and a charter for a new nation. But everybody applauded and cheered and was happy. It wasn't like that at all. One of the things that happened is at the end of the convention, there was a new spirit of people coming together, a new spirit of friendship. When they finally settled on the Great Compromise, where the small states would be protected by the U.S. Senate, where each state had 2 votes, same number of votes, whether you're a big state or small state, and the big states would be protected in the U.S. House of Representatives. That's where all the money bills had to originate. That was going to be apportioned according to population. Once that compromise was in place, everything else they could work out, everything else they could settle. And partially, as a number of people observed, it was because the weather broke. In early September, suddenly there was an edge of Pennsylvania autumn in the air, and things were cooling down. But also, Benjamin Franklin, in particular, with his speech about God and his speech about the need for prayer, had helped to present a new perspective where the delegates were reminded they weren't just working on a political issue. They were trying to draft a blueprint for government that was supposed to last for all time. Caledonia James, James Wilson of Pennsylvania, the Scotsman who played such a prominent role at the convention, said on the floor in one of the concluding debates, "We should consider that we are providing a constitution for future generations and not just for the circumstances of the moment." James Madison spoke to his colleagues and he said, "We are framing a system which we wish to last for ages and will decide forever the fate of Republican government." And one of the South Carolina delegates at the convention, John Rutledge, said, "As we are laying the foundation for a great empire, we ought to take a permanent view of the subject and not look at the present moment only." And so they came down to the conclusion of their work. They finally had a special committee led by Gouverneur Morris to put the words right, to create a preamble for the Constitution. They were going to have it copied over in what was called an engrossed version, which is somebody with particularly good penmanship would take a fine piece of parchment. Of course, that piece of parchment still exists. Write out all of these words perfectly, and then they were going to have a formal signing. That signing was going to take place on September 17th, which is still celebrated as Constitution Day and should be celebrated. And the signing was dramatic. But before that occurred, they had one big blowout celebration. And on September 14th, most of the delegates accompanied George Washington to a dinner party that was hosted at City Tavern. City Tavern was the biggest tavern in all of Philadelphia and probably in all of the nation at the time. It was huge, and they welcomed everybody in there. This was being hosted for the delegates by the local cavalry unit, the Light Horse Troop. By the way, that still exists in Philadelphia today. They still have the Light Horse Troop carrying on the tradition. They wear kind of these comic opera uniforms with lots of plumes and lots of gold braid. And the Light Horse Troop has always been famous for boozing. And we know that at this final celebration, they drank claret, beer, porter, Madeira, rum punch, and it says other beverages. We don't know how much they drank, but we do know that the Light Horse Troop got a special bill for extensive breakage because the delegates were particularly happy that they were done with their arduous labors. They were in a much more sober mood on Monday morning. That was September 17th. And the weekend had been turbulent. There had been clouds and some drenching rain. It was, after all, autumn in, or almost formally autumn in Pennsylvania. But the new week started off. It was clear. It was cool. There was that edge in the air, which is so sweet and delicious if you're in the middle Atlantic states. And as the delegates made their way to the State House, a lot of them realized they were going to see this old place for the last time. The State House is known today as Independence Hall. They looked around. They looked at all of the furnishings. This was going to be the last time, too, that they had the windows drawn, the shades drawn, because they were still trying to keep everything secret. That was part of the way that they proceeded. What's fascinating about this is the famous paintings of the signing of the Constitution. They all show light streaming in through the windows. The shades were drawn. That's a romanticization. But what happened was they went ahead, and before they got ready to sign, Benjamin Franklin rose unsteadily to his 81-year-old feet, and he wanted to address the convention. And, of course, George Washington, who was presiding over the convention as usual from the table in the front, it was on a little raised platform, he recognized Dr. Franklin, and Franklin, as he usually did when he spoke to the convention, handed a piece of paper to James Wilson, his colleague from Pennsylvania, because Franklin's voice was too unsteady. And this is what he wrote down and what James Wilson shared. "I confess that there are several parts of this Constitution that I do not at present approve. But I am not sure that I shall never approve them. For having lived long, I've experienced many instances of being obliged by better information or fuller consideration to change opinions, even on important subjects, which I once thought right, but found to be otherwise. In these sentiments, sir, I agree to this Constitution with all its faults, if they are such. I consent, sir, to this Constitution because I expect no better, and because I am not sure that it is not the best. I cannot help expressing a wish that every member of this convention who may still have objections to it would with me on this occasion doubt a little of his own infallibility, and to make manifest our unanimity, put his name to this instrument." It should have influenced everybody. It didn't. There were a bunch of delegates who had already gone home who were angry. The alcoholic Luther Martin from Maryland, he had already left. The two delegates from New York had already left. They hated the Constitution. The only delegate from New York left was Alexander Hamilton to sign the Constitution, which meant that New York couldn't formally sign it because you need to have two delegates there, and they didn't have two delegates left. And then there were three people, very important, who at the last minute said, "Nope, we're not going to sign. We don't like this document. We're now going to work to defeat it." One of them was Elbridge Gerry, who was a future governor of Massachusetts, a very important politician. And he had turned against the Constitution. He thought it was too much power to the federal government. One was George Mason of Virginia, who was upset, among other things, that the Constitution was too soft on slavery. And then there was Edmund Randolph, the governor of Virginia, the same guy who had put forward the Virginia plan and had helped to lead the Constitutional Convention. He decided, no, I can't support this. This will never be approved by the states. We're going to have chaos. We can't get this through. The rest of them signed. They stood up one by one, came forward to the table where George Washington was sitting. When Franklin got up, he needed to help to get up to the front. He was Carrie. He was 81 years old. He was weeping, weeping openly. And then he spoke once more. The final word at the Constitutional Convention delivered by Ben Franklin. And then they faced a fight, perhaps the most significant fight in all of American history, along with the Civil War, ratifying the Constitution. We'll tell you how that went and more in this special broadcast. Hillsdale College, uniquely, stubbornly independent, never taking a penny of government funding, either state, local, or federal. Find out about the great mission of this great college. Go to MedvedForHillsdale.com. That's MedvedForHillsdale.com. On the Michael Medved Show, a special broadcast, The Miracle of the Constitution. You're listening in the background to the President's March. It was written in 1793 in honor of President Washington, who was president at the time. 6 years before, he was a different kind of president. He was president of the Constitutional Convention, which finally signed the finished document for which they had reached painstaking agreement after 4 long months of debate. And finally, as each of the individuals stood up and signed the document at the president's table with Washington sitting behind it, a raised table in the front of the room, Dr. Franklin was helped back to his seat. And he got the last word at age 81, as was deserved. And as he wiped the tears from his eyes, he had cried openly while he was signing, because he understood this was the greatest, greatest work of his long, long life. He pointed to the chair on which Washington had been sitting all of those months. And the chair was decorated. It had a half sun, as it's called, that was on the back of the chair that would be obscured when Washington was sitting down, but he wasn't sitting down the whole time. So people looked at it. And here is what Franklin said. His words, not written down by Franklin, but they were recorded by James Madison, who from beginning to end, and this was the very, very end of the convention, wrote down the comments that he himself and other participants made. It's because of Madison and his writing all of that down that we have such good records of how the convention went. And Madison wrote down that Franklin had criticized the painters who had found it difficult to distinguish in their art arising from a setting sun. The old man said, "I have often and often in the course of the session and the vicissitude of my hopes and fears as to its issue, looked at that behind the president without being able to tell whether it was rising or setting. But now, at length, I have the happiness to know that it is a rising and not a setting sun." But before that sun could rise up into the firmament of nations and cast light on the whole world, which was the ambition of the founders, that's their vision for America, before they could do that, they had to win approval. And it was a complicated process, and there were people who were deeply, deeply opposed to the Constitution. John Lansing of New York, who was one of those two New York delegates who had fled from the convention in horror because they thought they were making the federal government too powerful, he denounced the Constitution as, quote, "a triple-headed monster," referring to the three branches of government, "as deep and wicked a conspiracy as ever was invented in the darkest ages against the liberties of a free people." That's right. He's talking about our Constitution that's actually worked out fairly well. In North Carolina, as soon as the information about the Constitution became public, a preacher got up and delivered a sermon on Sunday. And he fixated on a provision in the Constitution to create a new federal city, a permanent capital, instead of the sort of wandering capital they had under the Articles of Confederation. And that, of course, led to Washington, D.C. And the preacher said he feared that the new federal city would be, quote, walled and fortified. Here an army of 50,000 or perhaps 100,000 men will be finally embodied and will sally forth and enslave the people, who will be gradually disarmed. Does that sound contemporary or what? Folks even then were afraid of the city, Washington. The city of Washington hadn't even been planted or decided upon. Meanwhile, the first step in getting the Constitution approved was going to Congress, and this was not a slam dunk. Remember, there was a sitting Congress from the Articles of Confederation. They had authorized this convention, this federal convention, but only to alter, to revise the Articles of Confederation, not to start a whole new plan of government that would have put them out of business permanently. And here was the problem. Under the Articles of Confederation, in order to change those articles, in order to change the terms of union, you needed all 13 states to approve. They would never get 13 states. Rhode Island would have none of it. And there are probably other states that they assumed would not approve the Constitution. So you couldn't require 13 states as the articles did. That's why the Constitution itself says it goes into practice, it becomes reality, if 9 states approve it. So there was a huge argument in Congress. How can we go ahead and alter the Articles of Confederation with the approval of less than the full 13 states? So what they said is they said, look, we're just going to send this Constitution without recommendation out to the states and see what happens. And that's what they did. Each state was then charged by Congress not to either turn down or to approve the Constitution, but to go ahead and call a state ratification convention for the purpose of approving or disapproving the new plan for government. The first state to get to that, and they did it in December. Remember, they signed this document in September of 1787, September 17th. And by December, they had a ratification convention and they were debating it in Pennsylvania. But it was difficult to get the ratification convention. They had to go first to the state legislature. And the state legislature was very, very divided. There were a lot of people, particularly from the West, who didn't want this new constitution and thought it was a monstrous tyranny and it would take away their rights and it was no good. They didn't have a majority, but they were confident that if they waited for the election that year in 1787, they'd have a majority. Meanwhile, the pro-constitutional party, led by James Wilson and Benjamin Franklin, they wanted the thing to be approved right away. So what happened? There were 19 members of the legislature who ran away to deny a quorum, and they locked themselves into a hotel on 6th Street in Philadelphia. And they were going to stay there and deny a quorum so they couldn't vote on it until they adjourned, until they had the new election, and they could vote down the Constitution. Meanwhile, on a Thursday night, right before the Friday, the last day of the legislature, there was a lot of drinking going on, and a mob showed up at the hotel. A mob showed up at the hotel where the 19 runaway delegates were, broke into the hotel, and they actually grabbed 2 of the 19 physically and carried them back to the state house, to Independence Hall, which was the state capitol, carried them forcibly and deposited them in the chair, all with the approval of the sergeant of arms. And with these people protesting and screaming, no, no, we're not here, we're not here. The sergeant of arms said, yeah, you're here. They called the vote. It got narrowly approved. They then convened a ratification convention. And at that ratification convention, the pro-Constitution party prevailed by almost a 2-to-1 vote. However, there was violence that resulted from some of the anti-feds, that was anti-federalists, people opposed to the Constitution in Pennsylvania. Plus, there were big fights ahead in Virginia, in Massachusetts, in New York, and literally across the country. Fights led by great luminaries like Patrick Henry and James Monroe, for instance. And what happened in those fights? And how did the pro-Constitution side win? We'll get to that and more this special broadcast, The Miracle of the Constitution.
Music.
special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, The Miracle of the Constitution. And part of that miraculous deliverance that provided the Constitution of the United States involved the fight for ratification, where the forces and the leaders who were struggling to get the Constitution ratified faced very determined opposition. The opposition wasn't always polite. On December 12, 1787, just a few weeks after the Constitution had been drafted, Pennsylvania and the ratification convention there approved the Constitution by a lopsided vote. It was 46-23. And the people who had won that vote then decided to have a big rally and celebration in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. They had a huge bonfire that they made, and there was some refreshments served, which back at that time in America meant alcoholic refreshments, of course. And meanwhile, James Wilson, who had been such a leader at the convention, was supposed to deliver a long address about the importance of what had just happened. Well, he never got a chance to, because a number of people poured out of local taverns and knocked down the bonfire and started beating people. And they began beating James Wilson very severely. He was white-haired. They pulled his spectacles off. They knocked him down to the ground. He would have died, according to eyewitnesses, except a veteran of the Revolutionary Army, the Revolutionary Continental Army, interposed his body and accepted the blows. Wilson survived, but the rest of his life was difficult, partially because of the time he spent in debtor's prison. But meanwhile, the cause that he was identified with began to move forward. Pennsylvania had a great influence on Delaware, which was, of course, nearby and still is nearby, as a matter of fact. Delaware approved the Constitution. So did Georgia very early. But then there were big fights. And one of the most crucial fights was coming in Massachusetts, where Elbridge Gerry had been one of the delegates from Massachusetts. He did not approve the Constitution. And it was assumed that John Hancock, the governor, who was very popular at the time, was also going to oppose the Constitution and was going to oppose it very, very sternly and dramatically. Except Hancock surprised people, because one of the things that he did is, in times of crisis, he often decided to get sick and to dodge taking a position. A quick count of the ratification convention that was going to be held in Boston, it was too big. They had too many delegates. They had close to 600 delegates. So it was too big to take place in the state house, in the state capitol. So instead, they moved it over to a huge church. And that church, the Brattle Street Church, they took account of the delegates. It turned out that 201 out of 355 seemed ready to vote the Constitution down. If Massachusetts had turned it down, the whole thing would probably have been dead. So Governor Hancock kept being asked, "What's your position? What's your position?" He went home. He had the gout. James Truslow Adam, who's a historian, said that Hancock's two chief resources were his money and his gout. The first, always used to gain popularity, and the second, to prevent his losing it. So without Hancock there, they had raging debate. And the high point of the debate came when Amos Singletree, who was an elderly veteran of the militia from the Revolutionary War, and he was a struggling farmer from Worcester County in western Massachusetts, he tried to invoke the heritage of 1775. He said, "I say that if anybody had proposed such a constitution as this in that day, it would have been thrown away at once. It would not have been looked at. Does not this constitution take away all that we have, all our property? Does it not lay all taxes, duties, imposts, and excises? These lawyers and men of learning and moneyed men that talk so finely and gloss over matter so smoothly to make us poor illiterate people swallow down the pill, expect to get into Congress themselves. They expect to be the managers of the Constitution and to get all the power and all the money into their own hands. And then they will swallow up us little fellows like the great Leviathan, Mr. President. Yes, just as the whale swallowed up Jonah." Class warfare? You bet. Class warfare 1788 style, because now we're in the new year. Meanwhile, how do you answer someone like this, who says that the little people, the small people, feared the federal government? Sounds like the Tea Party, doesn't it? Yes, part of a very long tradition. The answer came from another poor farmer, Jonathan Smith, who spoke remarkably. We'll get to that and the miracle cure for John Hancock's gout. What was the miracle cure that helped to determine the fate of the Constitution and the fate of the whole republic? We'll get to that and more. Special broadcast, The Miracle of the Constitution. Like most people, getting in to see the doctor is more difficult than ever before. MyDiscountHealth.com gives you access to a doctor 365 days a year. That's why they created MyDiscountHealth.com with plans to save you time and money. Buy your plan today at MyDiscountHealth.com. Special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, The Miracle of the Constitution. And this show is available to you in its entirety, along with all of our other history programs, at MedvedHistoryStore.com. You can just go to MedvedHistoryStore.com and find out all about it. We're talking about the miraculous way not only that the Constitution was drafted, but ratified, because ratification was a complicated process with spirited opposition. Part of that opposition erupted in Massachusetts, where, according to all observers, a majority of the delegates who gathered in Brattle Street Church in Boston were opposed to the new Constitution. They didn't like it. Lots of people didn't like it, particularly from the western part of the state. And one of the reasons they didn't like it, as Amos Singletree made clear on the floor of the ratification convention, was because they thought it was done by the elites, by the merchants with their money and the slick lawyers, and that they were going to swallow up the little fellas, as he put it, like the great Leviathan. To answer him, another poor farmer stood up at the convention in a remarkable address. His name was Jonathan Smith. We know almost nothing about him, but he was from the Berkshire Mountains, and this is what he said. "Mr. President, I am a plain man and get my living by the plow." He spoke, by the way, slowly and forcefully. "I am not used to speak in public, but I beg your leave to say a few words to my brother plow joggers in this house. I have lived in a part of the country where I have known the worth of good government by the want of it. There was a black cloud that rose in the east last winter and spread over the west." He was talking about Shays' Rebellion, where so many people were in arms, died, were wounded. He then said, "Now, Mr. President, when I saw this Constitution, I found that it was a cure for these disorders. I got a copy of it, and I read it over and over. I had been a member of the convention to form our own state constitution and had learnt something of the checks and balances of power, and I found them all there. I did not go to any lawyer to ask his opinion. We have no lawyer in our town, and we do well enough without. I formed my own opinion and was pleased with this Constitution." At this point, he took a few steps toward Amos Singletree and pointed to him theatrically. "My honorable old daddy there won't think that I expect to be a congressman and swallow up the liberties of the people. I never had any post, nor do I want one. But I don't think worse of the Constitution because lawyers and men of learning and moneyed men are fond of it. I don't suspect they want to get into Congress and abuse their power. There was a time to sow and a time to reap. We sowed our seed when we sent men to the Federal Convention. Now is the harvest. Now is the time to reap the fruit of our labor. And if we don't do it now, I am afraid we shall never have another opportunity." This exchange between the two plow joggers, as they were referred to by Jonathan Smith, was the very heart of the conflict. And boy, was it close. No one knew which way it would go. So late at night, Sam Adams, who was a strong supporter of the Constitution, cousin of John Adams, one of the leaders of the Boston Tea Party, in fact, the leader of the Boston Tea Party, asked to see Governor Hancock in his very, very fancy mansion up on Beacon Hill. Sam Adams comes in with a few others, and says, "Governor Hancock, we need you. This will not be approved without you." Hancock says, "Well, I don't know. Then Adams says the magic words, "You can be more popular if you do this." And he actually hands to Hancock a speech that had been written out for him, in which he says, "Ratify the Constitution, but add a bunch of amendments restricting the power of government. For instance, restricting the power of government to interfere with freedom of the press, restricting the power of government to interfere with the right to bear arms, that kind of thing. What became the Bill of Rights? Hancock says, oh, yeah, this sounds great. So all of a sudden he announces he's well enough now to go to the convention, but he has a grand entrance where they announce all of a sudden, His Excellency Governor Hancock, and the doors swing open, and he has like two attendants who are carrying him into the hall. His legs are still wrapped up in bandages to show that he is still sick. But he goes to the front, he delivers a speech that was written for him, everyone applauds, and then shortly thereafter they voted. It was breathtakingly close. The final vote was 187 to 168. A switch of just 10 delegates out of 355 who voted in the final vote would have kept Massachusetts out of the new union and doomed the Constitution. Look, there were other close battles. There was one in New York, which was barely won. Alexander Hamilton, by the way, had organized a series of publications, a series of arguments that appeared under the name Publius. It was written mostly by Hamilton, some contributions by Madison, and some by John Jay, who hadn't been part of the convention. This later was bound together in a book called The Federalist. You've heard of it, The Federalist Papers. But these were arguments that helped in the intellectual world, but in the practical political world, there was still the problem of Virginia. Why was Virginia a problem when so many of the most prestigious advocates for federalism, James Madison, George Washington, were from Virginia? Because Patrick Henry, the greatest orator of the day, was totally opposed to the Constitution. In the Virginia Convention, he spoke again and again. He riveted people. What happened in Virginia was somewhat similar to what happened in Massachusetts. The governor swayed the final result. Who was the governor? Edmund Randolph. Wait a minute, you're going to say. Edmund Randolph was one of the people, one of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention who refused to sign it. He was opposed to it. Well, he changed his mind again. And this time he changed his mind because he saw that clearly the other states were going forward. Virginia had to be part of it. He very dramatically spoke to the convention and then carried barely enough votes to put the Constitution through. The Virginia vote was very close. Patrick Henry was asked to lead a rebellion against the ratification of the Constitution in Virginia. But he spoke to a rally for that purpose. The final vote was 89 to 79 for ratification in Virginia. The night after the final decision, the indignant anti-feds called a public meeting in Richmond to organize effective resistance. But Patrick Henry said, as true and faithful Republicans, you had all better go home now. And he was right. The fight was over. The rest of the states ratified. And even Rhode Island in 1790, about 2 years later than the rest of them, fell into place. What did it mean? How did it all happen? When folks looked at it at the time, and when you look at it through history, you have to see a hidden hand. We'll tell you about that and more this special broadcast, The Miracle of the Constitution. This special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, The Miracle of the Constitution, I want to acknowledge that I have drawn heavily from two books in particular that are both excellent, plus a whole bunch of other sources. But the two books that I want to recommend to you, one is called Miracle in Philadelphia by Catherine Rinker Bowen. It is a book from 55 years ago, but it is a tremendous piece of work, almost day-by-day account. The other is called Decision in Philadelphia. And it is by James Lincoln Collier and Christopher Collier. And it's also fine in even greater detail, particularly in terms of the context. When they had completed work on the ratification of the Constitution and they were getting ready to convene the new government, the people who had been involved in this work looked at it and marveled. James Madison, who was so much a part of everything, wrote in Federalist Number 37, "It is impossible for any man of candor to reflect on this circumstance without partaking of the astonishment. It is impossible for the man of pious reflection not to perceive in it a finger of that almighty hand which has so frequently and signally extended to our relief in the critical stages of the revolution." Alexander Hamilton, also part of the Federalist Project, he said, writing the Federalist Papers, It is a miracle that we are now here to exercise our tranquil and free deliberations on the subject. But he added, it would be madness to trust to future miracles. 1,000 causes must obstruct a reproduction of them. Fascinating. And the truth of the matter is, if you reflect back on it, there's so many small changes. Washington himself said it was a miracle that this thing was approved. Jefferson, watching from Paris, said it was an assembly of demigods who had achieved all of this. And there's so many times when it could have gone differently. If they hadn't dragged out those two men to ratify the decision of the legislature to call a ratification in Pennsylvania, if Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer hadn't gone for his little stroll at a key vote and allowed the convention to stay together, if the weather hadn't changed, if Edmund Randolph hadn't changed his mind in favor of ratification, if all these things hadn't happened, the Constitution doesn't happen. The new government doesn't happen. The government of the United States of America isn't launched. General Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina wrote in 1788 that when the General Convention met, no citizen of the United States could expect less from it than I did. So many jarring interests and prejudices to reconcile, but when the great work was done and published, I was struck with amazement. Nothing less than that superintending hand of Providence that miraculously carried us through the war, in my humble opinion, could have brought it about so complete upon the whole. It's still marvelous when you look back on it. What a miracle. What a joy. What a gift. What a blessing that we live in a land governed by this charter of liberty, the greatest nation on God's green earth.